On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
There is an awful lot in today's Sunday papers, and it's striking when you look at the front pages that there is no single dominant story across all the front pages, which means it's probably likely to be a busy hour as we go through them with Tanya Ward and Gary Murphy. A quick tour of the front pages. We'll start with the Sunday Independent this morning. Irish air traffic control in crisis, staff claim. Irish air traffic controllers have claimed that the system is in crisis and that staffing issues have led to an increased risk of an air traffic incident or accident. In an incendiary letter sent last week by up to 160 air traffic controllers to the Minister for Transport, Eamon Ryan, the controllers claim that over-reliance on overtime to run the service has now become a safety issue. And they say the crisis means that continuity of the provision of air traffic control service can no longer be guaranteed. Many controllers, it says, have refused to sign up to a voluntary call-in overtime system which is used to cover gaps in the roster. The letter claims that both Cork and Shannon airports have closed for a period in July, while closure at Dublin had been narrowly averted in August. And the Irish Aviation Authority has told the Sunday Independent that it has provided an update to the Minister for Transport outlining the factual position, but it does refute the allegations in its entirety. It says the company operates to the highest safety standards and at no point has safety ever been compromised and there's been no risk to air traffic control services in the last year. But I'd imagine that's a fairly significant thing, because as aviation does begin to pick up again after the pandemic shortfalls, given the responsibility that Ireland has for offering air traffic control to a lot of the Atlantic Ocean, the idea that there'd be some controls and staffing will no doubt be of interest to a lot of international carriers. We are also told on the front page of the Sunday Independent, in the one story which does get mentioned across all pages, that Sinn Féin and the Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney were among those who attended a church event last Friday, which was advertised as marking the centenary of the creation of Northern Ireland and the partition of Ireland. That is, of course, despite, as now as we all know, Michael D. Higgins deciding not to attend a church service in Armagh next month because the event is billed as, quote, marking the centenaries of the partition of Ireland and the foundation of Northern Ireland. Mr Higgins' decision not to attend that event has been backed by Sinn Féin, which says that it would also refuse to attend any such event if invited. But that's despite the party's Stormont Minister Declan Kearney attending the On These Steps event at the Presbyterian Church in Ireland's Theological Union, Theological College in Belfast last Friday. That event was supported by the Department of Foreign Affairs Reconciliation Fund, which is why, if you saw Simon Coveney on the news on Friday evening, it was at that event that he was attending. So we might get into that in a few minutes' time and with Doug Beattie later in the programme. The Business Post has an interesting follow-up to a story it had last week. You might recall I was talking about an Intel mega plant which might be delivered and how it was being described as mega fab. You might remember that because I made a joke that mega fab sounds like it's some sort of honorific or that it's a major compliment. People are saying that it's super brilliant. Mega fab is actually industry jargon for the sort of thing that it is. But we're told now on the Business Post front page today that the chances of Ireland getting this new plant now have been dramatically slimmed down, because Pat Gelsinger, the global chief executive of Intel, although confirming that Ireland is one of 10 countries on a shortlist of possible locations for the plant, which would bring 10,000 jobs, and Ireland remains on the shortlist, the tech giant has concerns about locating the facility here due to the unfolding energy crisis, and Germany is now believed to be in pole position to secure it. It comes as the government has new plans to import electricity generators worth hundreds of millions to the country, for the winter of 2022. A similar plan to get them for this year was abandoned last month. Basically, there is ongoing concern now about a growing mismatch between the amount of energy required to run the country in both domestic and industrial sections and what we're actually capable of providing. Basically, Intel don't seem to be too sure if it's worth delivering a kind of a mega facility like that to Ireland if they can't be sure that they'll literally be able to keep the lights on. We also learn on the front page of the Business Post, and people again might remember the story a couple of weeks ago where the Department of Housing decided to change the law earlier this year so that developers would not be obliged to provide 10% of new developments for affordable housing for a number of years. We're told that the controversial government decision to allow this certain land to be exempt from those requirements was taken following extensive lobbying from developers. This despite the department saying at the time that there was no external influence and that it was merely done out of legal concerns. The front page of the Sunday Times: Zippone defied officials to fly business class. This is not as part of her more recent quest to become a UN envoy. It's apparently due to the role that she previously had as a government envoy trying to secure Ireland's seat on the UN Security Council. We're told that Catherine Zippone, who was at the time the Minister for Children and Youth Affairs, flew business class in September 2019, despite clear guidance being given by the Department of Foreign Affairs that it would only pay for economy tickets. The department where Zippone was a minister at the time had to cover the €2,877 difference between the airfares. There's nothing in the records that suggests that Sapone had reimbursed the department for that amount, and she couldn't be reached for contact last week. Basically, this is over the time in which she was a Minister for Children and Youth Affairs, but she was flying over and back to New York as part of Ireland's campaign to get elected to the Security Council. There was one instance in which she flew over in economy class alongside her personal secretary, but on the way back, she flew business class. The Department of Foreign Affairs would only reimburse an economy fare, and nobody seems... based on this morning, at least, based on that piece in the Sunday Times, no one seems able to discern whether Catherine Sapone herself covered the difference or how exactly it was funded. We also learn on the front page of the Sunday Times this morning that opposition is growing within Fianna Fáil to sending any Irish ministers to that event in Armagh next month. Basically, it will be seen now as something of a scolding to Michael D. Higgins if a senior government figure was to be sent to represent the Irish state, Ireland, Republic of Ireland. We'll get to all that terminology in a little while as well. We're also told, by the way, that a new member of the RTE board who attended his first meeting last week says he's already considering resigning his directorship due to ill will in RTE over his appointment. Larry Bass, who's the chief executive of Shin Uill, which makes shows like Dancing with the Stars, says he was taken aback by the attitude towards him at his first meeting last Thursday. It seems his appointment upset a number of people, he said. There seems to be some concerns about conflict of interest, and basically he doesn't want to be around if he's not wanted. Finally for now, the Irish Mail on Sunday, they've done a new opinion poll which does, by the way, show 81% of people backing Michael D. Higgins in his decision not to go north, and there's a minor poll boost for Fianna Fáil on the back of the Catherine Sapone story. But we're told that 3 out of 4 people believe that employers should have the right to know if their workers have been vaccinated. As employees across the country prepare to return to the workplace, which is officially speaking from tomorrow, the poll shows an overwhelming 74% of people think that companies should be entitled to know the vaccination status of staff. Just over 1 in 5 believe that they shouldn't have the right to ask whether workers are vaccinated. The poll findings come after Tánaiste Dlia Varadkar published the latest version of the government's work safety protocol on Friday, which says that employers should not be entitled to know if their workers have received a jab because it's considered to be private medical information. That is your whistle-stop tour of everything making the front pages of this morning's papers. As I said, Tanya Ward, who's the chief executive of the Children's Rights Alliance, is with me in studio, as is Gary Murphy, professor of politics in DCU and author of the forthcoming book, Hottie, which is now available to pre-order in all good bookshops. And he'll thank me for getting that plug in so early in the show. Gary, the one common thread across all the front pages is different takes on Michael D. Higgins, the event in Armagh, whether it's right to go, whether it's not right to go. And there is any number of pieces, all of them, I have to say, well argued across the Sunday papers about whether he is right or not right to turn down the invitation to the piece next week. We'll start very open-endedly. Is there anything today in the papers that jumped out for you on that?
Well, what did jump out, Gavin, was the diversity of views. I mean, we have Martin Manser and Justine McCarthy are arguing trenchantly that the president was completely right. And the Sunday Independent, Joe Baelish, Hanlon and Colin Murphy arguing he was wrong. The editorials are contradictory. The Sunday Business Post accuses the organisers of being tone deaf, while the Sunday Times lays the same charge basically against the president himself. And I think it goes to the heart of this idea that we have this shared history. We don't have a shared history, really. We have a history in the state which is contested. It's contested by nationalists and unionists. And I think the president has kind of found himself, you know, it might be a slight touch of an own goal here, because I think, and the poll is really interesting. I suspect if he went and people asked, was the president right to go, he would still get an overwhelming majority. It's about him, I suspect, as distinct from his
Is he
decision.
Such a thought leader that whatever he did would be seen as being the right thing to do?
I think, indeed, that's much better put than I could do it. But what is interesting about the... about President Higgins is that he is clearly very thoughtful. We saw Deirdre Heenan, former member of the Council of State, argue this on Friday on a number of radio stations and TV programmes. And I think he is extremely thoughtful. He was very thoughtful when he was a minister. Famously, Des O'Malley said he would go mad when he went into office. But he was a very good minister for arts, culture, heritage and the Gaeltacht, I think the title was then. And he put arts and arts spending, and he fought for arts spending in cabinet. And he was a very good minister by all accounts. It's interesting, his row with John Bruton is one between two former colleagues in a government that I think generally people would consider was a good one, but shot itself in the foot by not getting re-elected because it called the election at the wrong time. So he is...
Makes you wonder if there had been a cabinet leaker at the time, what sort of gossip they would have been sharing in the back behind closed doors rows between John Bruton and Michael D. Higgins.
Well, quite, but I think the president, his popularity is such that, you know, the public have again rode in, and I think that's what that poll in the Mail tells us, for what it's worth, I think he probably has done the right thing, is my own view of it. The president doesn't want to get involved in, you know, there's lots of things about Michael D. Higgins. Is he over above politics, or is he of it so much? Mm. You know, he often makes these, you know, strong statements about the sort of neoliberal economy and the neoliberal agenda. There was a view that the government wasn't very happy with him around some statements. I always thought this was over, there was too much made of this. If the government didn't want President Higgins to win the 2018 election, certainly Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael would have put on a much better show. You know, they all rode in behind him, basically.
Yeah, they'd have put forward a candidate, wouldn't they?
I don't believe that Michael Higgins was a tremendously radical president or anything, but I do think he leads the country in a thoughtful and good way. And I would support him on this, because I think this idea that we all have this kind of shared history is somewhat erroneous.
The one thing which is useful about these polls, which are run by the Irish Mail on Sunday in conjunction with Ireland Thinks, is that they're all done by text message, which means that they can all be turned around very quickly. So the sampling for this opinion poll was actually only yesterday, and the opinion poll is something in the region of 2.5%. I'll get the exact details in a few minutes' time. But basically, this opinion poll asked people, should President Michael D. Higgins have accepted the invitation to attend an event to mark the centenary of the partition of Ireland? No, 81%. Yes, 13%. And then don't knows are merely 5%. The one thing, Tanya, that actually strikes me is that isn't it amazing how polarising these things can become, that only after a few days of controversy that as few as 5% of people are actually undecided about whether this is the right thing to do?
That's right. And when you consider there's a whole generation of people who obviously weren't around for partition, or even more recent generations don't really understand the significance of what partition did to the island of Ireland. And that really has come up, I think, through a lot of the coverage. I mean, there's a comment about commemoration isn't celebration, but I think it means something different for everyone, and that's probably what's underlying this position. So, you know, if you are the unionist community, it probably is a celebration that unionism has survived. But on the other side, if you were a victim of the Troubles and the violence and discrimination, you lived through the North, it's just a symbol of what you've actually been through, and it's not something to celebrate whatsoever. The thing, I suppose, that struck me about this, I mean, it's a really interesting point, Gary, I suppose, it was a very politically popular decision that he just made, but as you say, he is so politically popular, the public might have backed him either way on it. Probably that's the issue that strikes me, though, for the political leaders. They're probably thinking about what's happening in Northern Ireland at the moment, and how people are feeling, how unionists are feeling. You know, we know a lot of communities feel that their leaders have failed them, particularly around Brexit. We know there's high rates of youth unemployment in both communities, to be honest, in all communities, but particularly within the unionist side of things. And there's definitely a feeling that, you know, people lost out because of the Good Friday Agreement. I mean, the Good Friday Agreement was never sold to unionist communities, how it would make Northern Ireland a better place to live in for everyone. That never happened. And if you talk to...
Should the gains not have been a bit more obvious, though? Like, we've seen how Northern Ireland's been transformed in the last 23 years, that it was a place that nobody felt comfortable even investing any money in, let alone resources or time or anything else. Nobody wanted to create jobs there because nobody felt secure about places. I mean, look what they've gained since.
That's it. And that's very obvious to us. But if you talk to some communities in Northern Ireland, they don't feel like that. They feel like they've lost the police. The police isn't there to back them. They have the same levels of dissatisfaction that the nationalists have at this point in time. So I imagine some of the political leaders, Department of Foreign Affairs, probably saying, look, we could probably give up on this one because we need to try and work with unionist communities. We need to make them feel that we're on their side. This is, you know, it's a religious event as well. You know, is this the event to pick, to take a stand on? But at the same time, I completely take the point that the position that the president took was very considered. Ethics runs through his decision making.
Yeah, in fairness, he doesn't do anything
on a whim. He's setting some markers in the sand as well for future discussions and discussions around identity, I think, on Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I think John Bruton sort of missed the point by saying that the president was so constrained by the constitution. This president has always been of the view that the constitution does give him significant leeway to take decisions himself in relation to invitations, but also in what the president means to the country. And to Tanya's point about Northern Ireland, I also think Brexit has been a big fault line there, which has entrenched divisions. We saw Geoffrey Donaldson come out during the week in criticising the president, but, you know, he's also threatening to pull down the executive, which seems to me is a much more serious point in relation for people living in Northern Ireland.
We'll talk about that with Doug Beattie later this hour as well.
Yes.
But one other thing, just on the topic of the John Bruton problem, and maybe this is a 30-second little tangent into constitutional law that might not mean very much to many people, but the argument that was being made by John Bruton was that he didn't feel like the constitution had been complied with, because he seemed to believe that going to an event like this could be considered a function of the president, some sort of constitutional performance of his roles, and that therefore the government should have been asked. I don't think many people would consider how he fills his diary or the stuff that he goes to be a constitutional function, though, would you?
I wouldn't. Just to be blunt, Dan, in that 30 seconds, I mean, the president does have certain leeway of what he can and cannot accept. When he accepts something, it has to be run by the government. Mm. You famously had Charles Haughey not agreeing to Mary Robinson going to deliver the Dimbleby lecture, you know, 30 odd years ago, because he thought that was infringing on the political the prerogative of his government at the time. Mary Robinson had a completely different view, and she argued she was a constitutional lawyer, but she didn't go, which was the interesting thing. And I think John Bruton has been sort of over literal in his interpretation.
How much do you think the president's stance in the last couple of days is coloured by the controversy of the first week of 2020 and the proposed commemoration, and I use the word commemoration very deliberately, of the role of the Royal Irish Constabulary and the Dublin Metropolitan Police and all that followed that, and the perception that it was a celebration of the black and tans?
Yeah, I think he would be very well aware of it. Whether it was the deciding factor, I wouldn't be so sure. But certainly what we saw there was when Cathal Crowe, who then became a Fianna Fáil TD for Clare, came out and said that he wasn't accepting his invitation. Mm. Sinn Féin rode in, and before we knew it, the government was in an awful tizzy. And that had an important effect. We've done some research about why people voted as they did in the 2020 election, and certainly that set the tone for a very assertive Sinn Féin performance during the campaign and a very sort of reactive Fine Gael election campaign. Fianna Fáil got kind of stuck in the middle, and well, the rest is history.
Mm. Tanya, what do you make of the whole question of whether you can ever detach commemoration, whether commemoration is ever a totally neutral thing? Because it seems that a lot of the debate behind whether Michael D. Higgins or indeed anybody should attend an event like this is that some people see commemoration as being something of a celebration or a nod or an endorsement in some way, and others think that you can never fully detach the two. Where do you stand on it?
Well, I mean, what really strikes me in relation to it, because we know it's both, basically. Essentially, it's both. It's a celebration, and the other side, you know, it offends people to celebrate this partition. What really strikes me is that we haven't done more sophisticated work on public attitudes around these issues. You know, if you really want to bring the public behind you, and look, they had some time, because the Black and Tans issue was January of last year. Mm. So they had some time to think and prepare. And I think that work hasn't really been done with the public, North and South. We don't know what they think when they hear partition. We don't know what they think when they hear Black and Tan. We don't know what they think when they hear commemoration. And I think that's probably the bit that's missing, probably, in some of the political decisions that are being made. They're probably a bit instinctive. Mm. They're probably trying to read opinion polls. But like, we're working at the moment with the Children's Law Centre in Northern Ireland, and we've joined forces, the reason being because of this work around the Shared Ireland unit. And we want to make sure that the voice of children and young people is respected in all the big decisions that are going to be made about the future of the island of Ireland. But some of the things we've talked about is we actually don't know what people actually think around these issues. We don't know what children and young people actually think around these
issues. That's interesting, because
well,
I was just going to ask, if you were talking about trying to have like the voices of children heard on both sides of the border, you'd begin to then question how much partition and identity and nationality feeds into those questions. But I guess you're saying that you actually really don't know.
We don't know what they think on it. That, absolutely. We have no idea what they think. What we do know is when we talk to community groups, we get a sense, particularly in Northern Ireland, about youth dissatisfaction with the situation in Northern Ireland. But we don't know what they want us to work on. And I think we need to find those common points. You know, for us, it's child poverty, it's mental health. You know, they're very common issues north and south of the border affecting children and young people. But I think in any discussion about the future of the island or discussions about commemoration and partition, the starting point should be, what does the public think in relation to this? And what do we need to communicate to them in response?
Question then being, if we are going to be looking at more centenaries coming up, because this December will be the centenary of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, and then we're going to be looking at the centenary of Civil War. It kind of sounds like you think we need to get to grips with that all pretty quickly before we go anywhere near that.
Absolutely, because look, big changes are about to happen on the island of Ireland. I mean, there's a big change in the population in Northern Ireland, and there's real concern about what's going to happen in the UK if Scotland becomes independent. And you can't really trust the Tories in government, is the truth of it. Mm. And so when I speak to some human rights advocates in Northern Ireland, some of the things they worry about is the behaviour of the British government government, because even around the discussions around Brexit, very quickly you see articles appearing in the Telegraph about the cost of the people in Northern Ireland to the taxpayer, to the English taxpayer. So they very quickly can turn against you. So there's certainly a need to really plan how we do our work in this space and how we speak to the public in relation to this. And it's, look, we have a track record in this. If you look at the work of the Irish government on Brexit, you know, very senior people for a long period of time worked very hard to get that right. Mm. This is what we need to see, I think, in this space as well.
And the other thing is politics, and we often talk about politics here in the Republic being very fluid, electorally congested. Mm. You know, no one knows how the next election might turn out. Something similar has happened in Northern Ireland, where both the DUP and Sinn Féin lost significant ground in the 2019 general election. Mm. So it'll be interesting to see if there is, if the executive does collapse and how these new elections.
Well, there's going to be an assembly election by next May, if not earlier,
Well, but I would agree with Tanya's point about, you know, we need obviously to know more because there are more contested historical arguments coming down the line very, very quickly.
Well, certain contested things, maybe contested is the wrong word, but debated things include the name of the state, which is something that came up this week when Michael D. Higgins was complaining that the DUP and others in the North were referring to him as President of the Republic of Ireland. And
he did his best
Bishop Len Brennan and said, my title is the President of Ireland. Is he right to be so sensitive about nomenclature, which is so common to unionists north of the border anyway?
I think he has a valid point. I mean, nomenclature is important. Words are important. And I think that's what he was getting to about this, whether this commemoration of partition. And the Republic of Ireland, you know, as a state, like the naming of the state, that only exists since 1949 when Fine Gael did it, or the first inter-party government did it rather unexpectedly, as we know.
Well, the name of the state has been Ireland since 1937.
Ireland is the name of the state in the constitution.
Yeah.
Like even the office of Taoiseach only goes to 1937. People are always, you know, forgetting that. It's this thing from executive president of the first Dáil.
Yeah.
Some people may think he was a bit overblown, but you know, he is the President of Ireland. Now, there was a letter, I thought, in the Irish Times saying this would even confuse things even more. So was that claiming that he was President of those who live in Northern Ireland? You can take these things too far.
Is he President of the Irish nation or President of the Irish state, and the difference between nations and states and where you stop from there?
Also mentioned in the Constitution in Articles, famously in Articles 2, was it Article 2 and the naming of the state? But the name of the state is Ireland, I think.
So is he right then to get... But when we know that people of unionist persuasions north of the border don't like Ireland, the state, using the title Ireland, because it almost still lays claim to the entire island. Is it not fair enough that they might try to distinguish the two parts of Ireland by saying he's the President of the Republic? Like, is that not fair enough?
I think one could argue that, but I think more fundamentally is that the President has the authority and I think the right, the moral right, to state what his title is, no matter who made it.
It's his legal name. Yeah, it's a legal title of his
office.
That's
how I would view it. And, and I sort of view that the Irish state gave up quite a lot in the Good Friday Agreement, including the territorial claim, the new language, much more inclusive. But Éilis O'Hanlon in the Sunday Independent accuses President Higgins of laying waste
great spiritism of the time.
To the Good Friday Agreement in her piece, which I thought was slightly over the top.
Well, it's an interesting question though, Tanya. I do have to take a break and I'll take one in just a few minutes' time. But it seems that based on the way in which the debate has been taken up in the last couple of days, that it almost seems like it's impossible now to both aspire to get rid of partition, but also to accept the legal and political reality that partition exists and has been endorsed constitutionally by all parties for decades now. And it seems as if that you're no longer allowed to have aspirations and to accept where we are in the meantime, that anyone who accepts partition is now going to be accused as being a West Brit or a partitionist or a free stater, and that there's no nuance in debate anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's very unfortunate, because, you know, I would expect probably more coverage and discussion about what partition meant for the Ireland of Ireland. And actually, the outcome was very different, you know, north and south. I mean, at the time, it was such a tragedy for the south to lose its industrial heartland. Mm. And we really had no
idea. That's really forgotten, actually, the economic impact.
Yeah,
then
it was a major hit to the formation of the new state. And obviously, we didn't have any idea what was going to happen to Catholics and nationalists in the north. That wasn't apparent. What does come from some of the coverage today is that, look, they really had no alternative. If you looked at the facts on the page. You know, identity was coming up, Catholic identity, Protestant identity was rearing its head, and there didn't seem to be any economic reason to be part of the South. So it was part of the reality. But I do think it's a missed opportunity to look at what happened since, and the successes North and South and the failures North and South. I mean, I think it goes back as well. We need to revisit some of the themes in the Good Friday Agreement. And it's the issue of parity of esteem. You know, the good part of the Good Friday Agreement was it gave, now that mostly focuses, unfortunately, on two communities, but it gave them the option to be part of that community and to call themselves Irish or Northern Irish, whatever they wanted. And I think this is part of that. You know, the President of Ireland is the President of Ireland. That is his legal title. That's what we like to call him. Yeah. We call this part of the country Ireland. And I suppose we need to respect that people in the North call Northern Ireland something different as well.
Sure.
I think that we need to be comfortable about that, and people in the North need to be comfortable with that as well.
I'll be picking the brain of the leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, Doug Beattie, a little bit later in the programme. We might raise some of those topics with him. There is an awful lot written in today's papers. Just we've already mentioned some of them, but there's also a piece by Brandon McSivna who says that the show is over for unionism and that the idea of even commemorating partition is even too much of a nod to the past. Shane Coleman is in the Sunday Independent writing about how the name of the country is more than just a state of mind. There's various different pieces in the Sunday Times where Justine McCarthy says that Michael D. Higgins did us proud by skipping the service, but yet the editorial on the following page says the president misses the point by having the war of words over his title. There's an awful lot written. Just for one closing thought before I do go to a break, there was an interesting thread yesterday by Dr. Laura McAtackney, who is an associate professor of archaeology and heritage in Aarhus University in Denmark, but she just made a couple of interesting points which I thought were revealing. She made the argument, firstly, that commemoration is always a political act. And this is a thread that she wrote on Twitter that I'm quoting from. What the event is, who organises it, attends, how it's framed. It's all political. Secondly, to mark an event worthy of commemoration, it must have some contemporary relevance. Commemoration is never just about remembering what happened in the past, but it also interplays with the politics of the present, which I suspect is a point that Michael D. Higgins took up. Thirdly, the selections that make up the commemoration direct how it's going to be understood. Is it solemn, celebratory, sustaining, contradicting? Those choices frame the event. They indicate how the intended audience is supposed to receive it. Agreement to be involved is also tacit acceptance. Fourthly, no two commemorations are the same. They're individually shaped not just by the factors in the control of the organisers, but also outside their control, including the timing and the external reception. Individual decisions have to be made on their appropriateness. Fifthly, all commemorative events assume narrative hospitality. By inviting attendance, you are presuming that the invitee buys into your framing and the representation of the event being commemorated. This, by necessity, places an implicit burden on the invitee to assent to it, which seems like a really important point. The final point that she made is that faux outrage that declining to attend commemorations of contested events, claiming by their very existence to be reconciling, that's not the problem. The problem is claiming that that commemoration is reconciliation when often it is the opposite. It's a really interesting thread. I'm not doing it nearly justice here. I'll retweet it right now. Gav Riley on Twitter is where you'll find it. Gary, very briefly.
Well, it's a very interesting thread and I read it, but the thing that struck me about it is to take it to a logical conclusion. No president would ever take up any invitation because of the fear that it might somehow be overstepping some sort of commemorative mark. And I don't know Laura very well, but I know her work. She's very able. But I thought logically, you know, where would it end? Would the president take up anything? Would he be so worried? And we do have
that. Wonder that, because it's only a couple of weeks since we've had commemorations for the 20th anniversary, for example, of September 11th, and nobody's going there saying that they endorsed what happened,
or that they endorsed
the consequences.
You know, and as the front of one of the papers today says, you know, both Simon Coveney and Sinn Féin attended an event, was it yesterday?
Friday.
Yeah,
with pretty much an identical name.
Exactly.
Which is, again, a point that I'll put to Doug Beattie later on. We genuinely could talk about this until the cows come home, but there is also some other day-to-day politics and other issues, like, for example, the cost of childcare mentioned in today's papers. We'll be back with Gary and Tanya in just a minute. When you get past all the Michael D. Higgins, is this a republic, is it not, is he right to go, is he not right to go, is it more controversial to attend or not to attend, once you get past all of that, there is a lot written, Gary, in today's papers about think-in season and the return of the Dáil and the frisson that there was and the motion of no confidence in Simon Coveney, and an awful lot bizarrely written about the Dáil canteen serving Christmas dinner last Wednesday, which is a real festive thing which I won't even bother trying to get into. But one thing which is fascinating is perhaps the opinion poll again in today's Mail on Sunday. We've already mentioned it in the context of Michael D. Higgins, but also this sense again that Sinn Féin are really consolidating where they are. And you were writing yesterday in the Irish Daily Mail about some of the consequences of that.
Yeah, I think the May the Ireland Thinks poll, leading on from last week's Sunday Times Behaviour and Attitudes and Sunday Business Post Red Sea, shows a consolidation of Sinn Féin support in and around 29-30, up even up to 32%. That would give them 6% more than they got in the general election, where they had 37 seats. So you're looking at 50 seats probably in a general election. All those seats that they won, to their own surprise, in places like Clare, Tipperary, etc., would be copper fastened. They would certainly win two seats in places like Waterford, Mary Lou MacDonald's own constituency, Dublin Central. Probably places like in the west of Ireland. So that's what we're seeing there. Fine Gael, well, you know, it's a 23%. They're down in the Mail. And Fianna Fáil are up a bit to 19%. But again, they're lower than the general election, particularly in Fianna Fáil's case, who, you know, are bouncing anywhere between 13% and 20%. So, you know, you're below general election territory, which is in the mid-30s range. So I do think we are seeing a certain stability in the polls. Now, the point I was making, you know, to give some hope to the governing parties is politics, for the most part, in my view, is about hope and about the future and about, and people vote on those trends. And we're seeing this much more so in Ireland now. The days of Fianna Fáil getting 40%, Fine Gael getting 32%, and everyone fighting over the rest are long gone. Campaigns matter much more. But what we can see is Sinn Féin, and they have some very impressive representatives. I mean, I was very critical of Matt Carthy in parliamentary privilege yesterday. And
well, you were. We'll come back to that
in a
minute.
And it remains so. But people like David Cullinan, Mary Lou MacDonald herself, Donegh O'Leary in education, Louise O'Reilly on workers' rights, they have some very impressive people. And I think that's what really has brought Sinn Féin to the sort of position they hold. And now they're the key for them, of course, is to get more of the people who are less well known out and about, and to mark the cards of the government. I think though that certainly for Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, the trend in these polls is clearly worrying.
To go back to the Matt Carthy incident, because it was the one which I think has attracted most attention in the day since the Dáil actually sat. This was the incident where he used parliamentary privilege to allege that Simon Harris was behind a cabinet leak around the appointment of Catherine Zappone, and he mentioned an alleged sting operation within Fine Gael, allegedly run by the junior minister Patrick O'Donovan, although he denies that charge. Parliamentary privilege is a kind of a curious one, because most people would say, is the point of parliamentary privilege not that you can say stuff which deserves to be on the public record? And that if something surely as grave as who is compromising the confidentiality of a cabinet meeting is surely a good a reason as any to use parliamentary privilege?
That would be the case if the person then giving or making the statement on the record in the Dáil had some evidence themselves. And we saw, we heard Matt Carthy on the news at one the following day with Justin McCarthy saying he had no evidence. And now Sinn Féin and their supporters come out with some tortuous sort of language to say what he was saying was about the sting operation as a thing from the leak itself, which just seems to me, you know, far-fetched, to put it mildly. I mean, he did what he did. Parliamentary privilege is very important because it holds, you know, it holds people to account who mightn't want things said. Famously, Catherine Murphy about Dennis O'Brien and Siteserve, and I thought it was a very useful use of parliamentary privilege. Someone from Sinn Féin attacked me on Twitter last night saying, you know, well, did I agree, you know, with gross abuses of parliamentary privilege for members of Sinn Féin? And of course not. You know, I abhor the abuse of parliamentary privilege in all its shapes and forms. I think what happened here, though, was an abuse. And if it's let stand, and this is the point I was making, if Simon Harris lets it go, this will then be tacitly, in my view, accepting, you know, that anybody can literally say anything about anybody in the Dáil, and then it'll become pointless in the longer term. And I think that was my worry. And I think Sinn Féin should reflect on it.
Well, I think one thing which is interesting about that is that Simon Harris has also disclosed that he's about to go on a fortnight of paternity leave, which means that he might not even be around Leinster House to consider making an official complaint. But, I mean, again, it sort of has to address the question as to, is the whole point of parliamentary privilege not to give ventilation to allegations as serious as this? Okay, granted, doing so without evidence is a fairly awkward thing, and Matt Carthy became definitely unstuck when Justin McCarthy excellently pressed him about it on Friday. But the point remains that it is quite literally a privilege which is there to be used, is it not?
It is, but I repeat, it has to be used carefully and in consideration. And, you know, I watched Matt Carthy, I watched him back And it seemed clearly he was in full rhetorical flourish. And it just seemed to me, you know, not appropriate. And, you know, and Simon Harris has clearly denied it. I understand Patrick O'Donovan has also denied being the source of the sort of the sting operation.
You know, a Colleen Rooney, Rebecca Vardy style operation.
Yeah, Sinn Féin will probably be in government at some stage, or what they would hope after the next election. You know, and I just think these things need to be thought through very carefully. And whether he meant to do it or not, because he said he hadn't told Miriam Lou MacDonald, and the Kyon Court also came in saying, you know, if you're going to make allegations about fellow members in the House, there is a courtesy that you should leave the Kyon Court and know in advance. That wasn't done. So whether he got carried away, but he certainly wasn't. You know, he wasn't coming. He wasn't coming back to with Justin. So I just think that Sinn Féin need to reflect on it.
You've been reading both Gary's piece and all of today's papers. What do you want to jump in on?
I suppose one of the pieces that does stick out is around Alan Shatter. There's a piece on the back page of the Sunday Independent. And again, I think it's really an article about politics, because he's essentially saying, you know, there's a difference with how political leaders behave publicly and privately. So obviously, Alan Shatter lost his position. He effectively had to resign from his role as Minister for Justice. And he was subsequently cleared by O'Higgins and in a Supreme Court judgment. And
so he had to resign over the findings of a report by Sean Gearan, but he complained that he hadn't been interviewed by Gearan, and then eventually, after a fairly tortuous legal campaign, he had the offending parts of Gearan's report quashed, which means that the grounds on which he was forced to resign basically were discredited by the courts later.
That's it. And he's making the point that he received very supportive text messages from Leo Radker and from Simon Coveney. And why in that case are they not making, I suppose, public statements vindicating him? And what struck me about that is I think this is about politics. And I'm going, thinking back to that period, I remember we had Alan Shatter as Minister for Justice come and speak at an event for the Children's Rights Alliance. And it was on the Children and Family Relationships Bill, which was actually really radical for Irish law. But the Irish public wouldn't have known, because we actually found it very hard to get real coverage of the events. And one of the things that our comms officer heard from talking to a journalist, that's not the editorial line we're going for in relation to Alan Shatter. And I remember in the same period talking to some of the political parties, and they were saying, on the doorsteps for the local elections, I think it was at that time, they were hearing Alan Shatter's name on the doorsteps, and Fine Gael needed a solution. And it was around, you know, the constant media coverage around Alan Shatter that he made the wrong decision. So I think one of the things here he's picking up is, if I was right, the right thing to do is to vindicate me. But obviously the real reason why he hasn't been publicly vindicated is because of the politics of the time and the way the story is being covered, that it was politically expedient to move him on at that point in time.
Yeah. The ultimate point that Alan Shatter, I think, is trying to make in this piece is that when he says he joined Fine Gael, it was because he was attracted to its sense of decency, and he heard Simon Coveney mention the decency of his colleagues in his Dáil speech on Wednesday, and he's wondering where that decency has gone, because he gets a lot of behind closed doors support, but when it comes to the public record, he's found it very difficult to get any modicum of sympathy. I do need to go and take a quick commercial break, but finally, Gary, is there just anything briefly that you want to mention, or can we go on to a break?
Well, there's two important pieces, one by Elaine Byrne in the Business Post and one by Jody Corcoran in the Sunday Independent, which talk about, you know, Fine Gael as the supposedly genteel party, but the stilettos being off behind the backs of all of them. And then there is this constant view, just quickly, that and Jody mentions it today, that somehow Leo Varadkar, Pascal Donoghue and Simon Coveney are all looking for an exit strategy, whether this is Europe or the United States or the central bank, and that's something to watch, because the future of Fine Gael,
indeed,
I mean, is not quite at risk, but you know, the poll numbers speak for themselves.
There's a generational change coming. All I will say by way of coda to that is that people might know it. Once upon a time I wrote a book about the manner in which Enda Kenny was removed as Fine Gael leader, and there's a fair amount of backstabbing in it, but the stuff that I was told off the record that I could not commit to the book, There's a whole other conversation over feeder points there. We will come back with a discussion around COVID, the cost of childcare and online child abuse with Gary and Tanya after this. Still joined in studio by Gary Murphy from DCU and Tanya Ward of the Children's Rights Alliance. And Tanya, you were particularly taken by a piece on page 18 of today's Sunday Independent, a piece by Ali Bracken about the conviction this week of Eric Owen Marquez, who was extradited from Ireland to the United States and this week was given a 27-year sentence for being the world's largest facilitator of child sex abuse imagery. And there's some interesting points that are raised by the manner in which he was prosecuted and what more we could do to apprehend more like him.
That's right. I mean, this is so absolutely, utterly essential that we invest in this area, because there's been the two things about this case, and it's a point that there's an interview in Ali Bracken's piece with Chief Superintendent Declan Daly, who's Head of Protective Services in the Gardaí. And one is that even if you just distribute these images or look at these images, you are equally responsible for these crimes being committed against children, because you're creating demand. You are putting pressure on a criminal somewhere to exploit and abuse a child to really facilitate this industry so they can make money. And the other side of it is, if you talk to 1 in 4, and they work with people who've been convicted of abusing children, and they say images of child abuse is a real stepping stone to people actually committing crimes against children and young people. It normalises the behaviour, and then they're more likely to abuse a child. So, you know, I know when they run these types of operations, I mean, they're mostly led by the US. The FBI has very sophisticated software. What they do is, when they run the programme, it drops pins down and they're able to see where people are actually looking at images of child abuse online. But the issue is, there's so many pins being dropped down, they can only get to a certain proportion of those offenders. And that really concerns me, to be quite honest with you, because we have seen cases in Ireland, sometimes it's taken up to 10 years to prosecute these cases. Sometimes they're very complex, there's a lot of background work that the guards need to do, but sometimes it's down to they don't have the capacity to investigate and prosecute them. And in the meantime, the person who's looking at the images of child abuse could be looking at more images of child abuse, or in fact, they could be committing a crime against a child or a young person.
So if the argument is that by pursuing these sort of images online, that it almost becomes, sorry for not having a more eloquent way to put it, but if that becomes your gateway towards actually abusing children, and if the guards only have the ability to apprehend a small fraction of people who are actually consuming the images, that means that basically on their watch, through under-resourcing, they're almost, another generation of child abusers is enabled.
That's right.
The guards don't have the means to get to the bottom of it.
That's right.
That's frightening.
Yes, it is frightening. And the other side of it is, of course, is that the guards actually are able sometimes to identify children in these child abuse images as well. They've actually been able to save children. The Irish Gardaí are responsible for identifying a group of children who were being abused in Vietnam. So the more you invest into this, from an investigation point of view, the more children you're able to save. I mean, we talk a lot about in Ireland about child abuse in the past, and about the legacy issues and the sins that our country was responsible for. But this is the child protection issue of our day. This is what we should be investing our resources in. I mean, his interview with Ali Bracken comes up at a very timely point, because, you know, Department of Justice will be doing its pitches to DEEPR to get resources. I hope they are going for very significant resources to prosecute in this particular area. I'd be very disappointed if we don't see a big increase of funding going into this area, because this case involving Eric Marquez, it really shows that Ireland, you know, is also, can be a location for a mass distribution of these type of images.
But I suppose the takeaway point from all of that is that if the Gardaí know that there is a bigger network out there that they don't have the resources to catch, that they know that they have an escalating problem which is going to get worse on their watch, and that they are not disinterested in trying to stop it all, but that they are just ill-equipped to do so.
That's right. And look, and I think part of
it is, they know it's going to get worse and they can see it happening, but they just don't have the means to step in to try and avert it in some
way. That's it. I mean, what they will tell you is that they are seeing cases where they're seeing repeat offenders. So they know then some of the software is working for them. They know they are actually getting to those. If they get to prosecute them twice, three times, they know they're actually getting to the source of the problem. But the issue is, there are lots more people involving this, engaged in this activity. It's becoming a lot more prevalent. But the other thing I'd say is, we do need to put the focus back on the tech companies themselves. They actually can stop this content from spreading online if they want to. Like, what websites like Pornhub, any other social media websites, they can actually stop the spread of this information. Because if you look at a country like China, and I'm not saying that's what you want to emulate, but how come in China they're able to stop ordinary content that's really important for ordinary citizens? How come they're not able to segment and select out this material and stop it from spreading? So we need to resource the Gardaí, but at the same time, we need to get these platforms to step up to the plate and invest in stopping this content from spreading online.
It's a really sobering thought. And Gary, I'm sorry to have to reduce it to maybe about 30 seconds worth of your reaction, but I suppose all of this illustrates just the difficulties that, now that money is going to be slightly harder to come by, that the government can't continue to borrow at a rate that it's done, that you're going to have to pick and choose your causes. And unfortunately, major issues like that are possibly going to be the victims when it comes to divvying up the pie.
Yeah, and there's a couple of editorials today about warning the government to be cautious in its spending, you know, because the government has spent vast amounts of money, as governments all across the world have, in terms of trying to cope with the pandemic. What struck me about the case was, you know, Sometimes the guards come in for tremendous criticism, but kudos to them in this particular case. And it was also striking while this character Marquez was very keen to have his case not to be extradited, because the sentence he received in the United States was far in excess of what he could have expected to receive here. So maybe we should be revisiting our sentencing policy. I'm not usually one for hang them and flog them, but certainly in the case of these just appalling, abhorrent case, maybe we should be looking at our sentencing.
Yeah, there's definitely
you don't want Ireland to be the place, you know, you decide to go because you're going to get a lower sentence.
Exactly.
Which is a horrifying thought, but one I'm afraid we're going to have to close on. Tanya Ward, Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance, Gary Murphy, Professor of Politics at Dublin City University. Thank you both very much for coming in to talk to me this morning.
On the Record
with Gavin Riley
on News Talk